I'm telling these tears, go and fall away, fall away. Oh, may the last one burn into flames. Freedom, freedom, I can't move.
What's up, Wisconsin?
Freedom, cut me loose, yeah. Freedom,
I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. We've got our special continuing live coverage from downtown Milwaukee of the 2024 RNC. Happy Wednesday, everybody. I took a couple, I don't know, about 2 hours this morning and walked around the convention. I saw, let's see, five people. I saw Kellyanne Conway. I saw Roger Stone, Corey Lewandowski, Carrie Lake, and then, not to be forgotten, Governor Greg Abbott. I'll tell you all about the sights and sounds of the convention a little bit later. You're not going to want to go anywhere. And remember, Civic Media's got you covered every night of the convention. We have primetime coverage across the network from 7 to 8 p.m. And, of course, you can find all things RNC news at civicmedia.us/RNC. But right now, I am joined by two very special guests. Really excited to have them both. Former 2nd District Congressman, Republican Scott Klug, and the former head of Wisconsin's Democratic Party, Mike Tate. Welcome, Mike. Thank you so much for being here. Scott, thanks for picking up the interview in your car, it looks like, sir. That is impressive.
That's a sign of dedication, and the fact that the part of the true story is that my ticket at the Marquette ticket ramp would not work. So I had to scramble around to find somebody back into my car so I could get out. So security and bad ticket meters prohibited me from joining Mr. Tate in person.
Well, we really appreciate you making the effort. You two gentlemen are here as a part two of the guests that joined me yesterday, including former Republican Attorney General for the great state of Wisconsin, J.B. Van Hollen, and former Lieutenant Governor, Democrat Mandela Barnes. You two gentlemen, Mike and Scott, you also are part of the Democracy Defense Project. Representative Klug, I'll begin with you. Why did you join the Democracy Defense Project? What are you trying to accomplish?
Well, I think we're simply trying to assure Wisconsin voters that the election system works here. It's pretty crazy that we're in July and people are talking about election fraud. Nobody's cast a single ballot. I think Mike and I are here to say, look, we disagree about lots of things. Sometimes, very angrily disagree on things. But here we both agree that the system's worked well. And I just want to sort of, hit the middle of the target straight on. The claims are that in Wisconsin in 2020, that the election fraud was off and cost Trump the election. Trump lost to Biden by 12,000 votes. If he simply would have gotten the votes for all the Republican congressional candidates in the state, he'd have won by 45,000. So if there was a great plot to steal the election, why didn't they steal the election from the 6 members of the Wisconsin Republican congressional delegation? So I think that just sort of explains what got us here because, look, within an hour of Trump being shot in Pennsylvania, the Democrats were blaming the Republicans and the Republicans were blaming the Democrats on all kinds of crazy social media stuff. And it's about time we just all caught our breath and stuck to the facts.
Yeah, when it comes to elections, the facts are indisputable and clear. Mike, how are you getting the Democracy Defense Project's message out to folks across Wisconsin and in the other states where the project is also active?
Yeah, we're active in 8 states. I won't name them all right now, but I think that it is all the swing states that are out there. This is really, it's about people who've served in roles in the Democratic Party, elected officials like Congressman Klug and the other folks here, and myself, who served as state party chairman for 6 years. And just like Congressman Klug said, hey, you know what? Elections are about putting forth your ideas on how we can move the country forward. This is the court of public opinion. I believe in a aggressive fight for your ideas. But then I believe we have an election day. People have cast ballots. We count the ballots. The loser should call the winner and congratulate them and wish them the best. And then we get to work. And you know what? 2 years later, everyone in America is legally allowed to overthrow the government again, which I think is a pretty awesome thing. And we do it through a peaceful transfer of power. And what scares me the most is a loss of trust in our electoral system especially when I believe and I know it is completely unwarranted that Wisconsin has among the safest and most effective and efficient voting systems in the country. And I think it's important that Democrats and Republicans stand together on that issue.
Couldn't agree with you more. You basically brought up what I refer to as playground rules. When you lose, you lose, and don't be a sore loser about it. And in an election process, you concede and you acknowledge the victory of your opponent. Representative Klug, let me ask you, I've heard from a lot of our callers and listeners, people are genuinely afraid. Like, they have actual fear in their hearts. As a conservative, as a Republican, sir, are you afraid? Do you share those anxieties? What can you tell people to assure them?
Well, I think you can tell them that, you know, the only claim that was substantial in the last election was that the former president lost. And back to my earlier point. But I think here's the one thing I think that gives people the heebie-jeebies, and it's a shame the Wisconsin legislature didn't fix it this time around. There was a bill introduced. A lot of the conspiracy theory in Wisconsin has circled Milwaukee County, and the fact that there are trucks that pull up early in the evening, late in the evening after the polls have closed, to deliver ballots. Well, the reason they have to send the trucks at night is because, in contrast to a good Republican state like Texas, in Texas, they actually start counting the absentee ballots when they arrive. Other states don't count them, but they open them all so that they're ready to go instantaneously. And watch how fast the Texas election gets called on election night, and how long it takes Wisconsin.
Much bigger state too at that, Scott. Much bigger state.
Absolutely. So there's a very simple fix. Now, here's the other thing that's even crazier. After the Bush-Gore election, there were a lot of election reforms put in place, and one of them are cameras and counting centers. And the reason it was done is because people did not like how Fort Lauderdale had handled their ballots and elections for, you know, 15 years. But here's the problem. There's no play-by-play, right? So the three of us are working in an election center, and Maggie, I hand you a box, and then 2 minutes later, you hand Mike a different box, and then I open an envelope, and then I walk in the back room where you can't see me, and suddenly everybody's convinced that we're wiring the election on camera. So here's a perfectly smart election reform Republicans and Democrats agreed on. And if you told and explained this to the public, in normal times, they'd go, that makes a lot of sense. But now every nod of the head, every move box, every shrug of the shoulders is taken as a conspiracy and trying to throw the election. So it's people just need to catch their breath and let rational calculations take effect.
Yeah.
How do we break through that bubble, Mike? Because I experience it, and I nod my head furiously at what Representative Klug is saying. Yes, of course. And I myself was the general counsel for Milwaukee County during the 2020 recount. I have personally witnessed the painstaking, technical, ticky-tacky manner in which ballots get counted. There's no smoke and mirrors. It takes a lot of effort and time and incredible attention to detail. And that's what we've got here, and the election process works. But it seems that those facts, that rationality that the representative spoke of, it's not getting through to people. How do we burst the bubble, Mike?
Well, some of it, I hope, is the work that we're doing right now with the Democracy Defense Project, where you have, you know, pretty partisan people in their politics, but they're united in that what's more important than what we believe is the right issue approach to any number of issues. But the most important thing is that voters trust the results. And I thought Congressman Klug hit on a great point, which is let Milwaukee, the largest municipality in the state, the largest county in the state, do what any number of other states do. Prepare the ballots beforehand. Start counting the ballots beforehand. So when the election results inevitably come in at 3 a.m. and people are like, oh my gosh, how did that happen? There's a really easy reason that happened. They can't start counting the ballots until the election's over.
Can't even open the envelopes in the state of Wisconsin.
No.
And when I talk about the brass tacks, the pragmatics of getting the envelopes open and how long it takes to collate, and we have a quadruple checking process just in terms of number of ballots and then the way that the votes are cast, all sorts of audit checkpoints. It takes a long time to do that. I'll echo the representative. I was so disappointed when that bill died here in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
It, it, What can we say to people? Should folks be calling their state representatives here, their assembly persons, and their state senators and saying, pass the bill that allows us to start counting?
Yeah, I mean, let me say, one, I think that's a great idea. It's always good to contact your elected officials. But two, I think it's, you know, hear what we're saying. And beyond, you know, the fact that, look, the law is not going to change before the August primary and the November general. Milwaukee's ballots, I promise you, are going to come in late. They're going to come in the wee early morning hours. And I remember 4 years ago with the COVID election, sitting on my couch watching the then Milwaukee elections commissioner with a flash drive in her pocket being escorted. But look, the other thing is, you know, you can call for a recount. We've recounted the last two elections. Nothing wrong with that. If you're within one percentage point of the vote, and as you said, Maggie, you've watched a recount. It is a very transparent process where we count the votes again. There's less than a handful of votes that'll switch. But we have so many processes in place to guarantee that we have a safe, secure election. And we just need to go about educating the citizenry so that they don't believe these dog whistles and lies that they can't trust the election system. It is fundamental to this democracy.
I'm joined this half hour by former Wisconsin congressional representative for the 2nd District, Republican Scott Klug, as well as Wisconsin Democratic Party chair, former chair Mike Tate. We're going to take a couple of important messages, come right back with the gentlemen. They're part of what's called the Democracy Defense Project. You can find out more about their work at democracydefenseproject.org, because elections work in Wisconsin. They work in the United States. Everyone can trust this process. We probably do it about as well as it can be done here in the United States. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network special live coverage from downtown Milwaukee of the Republican National Convention 2024. Don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
Keep on running, cause the winner don't quit on themselves.
The process is rigged. This whole election is being rigged.
Cause baby, now we got bad blood. You know it used to be mad love. So take a look what you've done. Cause baby, now we got bad blood.
Hey, I can't take it back. Look where I'm at.
Welcome back, Wisconsin. My name is Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network's special live coverage of the 2024 Republican National Convention. My two special guests this half hour are former chair of the Democratic Party of Wisconsin, Mike Tate, and former Wisconsin congressman for the 2nd District, Republican Scott Klug. Welcome back, gentlemen. Mike, I wanted to ask you, and Scott, I'll ask you the same question. What do you think about the tone of the RNC so far, given the purpose, the objectives of the Democracy Defense Project, specifically Mr. Hovde's speech last night, as well as Senator Ron Johnson?
Well, I'm sort of delaying here to see if Scott... If the congressman wants to go first.
Scott, would you like to go first?
If he doesn't, I'm happy to jump in. But I was just trying to be deferential to a former member of the United States House of Representatives.
Yeah, well, the former member of the House of Representatives will have to admit that I didn't see either of the speeches in their whole. So all I've really seen are brief clips. So, let me talk about a different issue, I think, coming for the Republicans out of the convention. I expect that Trump will give a very toned-down Trump speech Thursday night and talk about unity and talk about coming together. What I'm going to be interested to see is what the Trump speech is like a week from Thursday, to see if it keeps the same theme. And as you know, the Biden campaign shut down commercials over the weekend after the shooting and has largely stayed relatively quiet. So it'll be interesting to me to see how quickly we're back in a street room brawl, or if the shooting can actually be a break in the way we've behaved the last 10 years and usher in, you know, a situation where people can actually talk to one another respectfully.
Yeah, I mean, one point I'd make is I'm interested to see what Senator J.D. Vance says tonight.
Cause yes.
He was one of the first officials to comment after the shooting, in which he specifically blamed, I believe, President Biden and the Democratic Party for the shooting because of the rhetoric. And I think both sides have acknowledged, and I hope it stays this way. I'm sure the congressman agrees with me. If we can tone down the rhetoric and focus on the issues, that's going to be better for America and best for democracy. But, you know, this is who, you know, he was the first guy out of the gate saying, oh, my gosh, you know, this shot taken by this, you know, lone wolf person, which was obviously a tragedy. Thank God, you know, former President Trump was not injured worse in any way. I mean, we're very lucky in that respect. I think that would have been terrible for this country. But, you know, J.D. Vance was saying, oh, this is Joe Biden's fault. It's like, come on. You know, and so I'm interested to see what kind of tone he strikes tonight. But again, you know, we're here talking about, you know, why everybody in Wisconsin, regardless of what city you live in, whether you're in Menasha or Milwaukee or in between, when you go to cast your ballot, whether you vote early, whether you vote by mail, whether you vote on Election Day, you should have every full faith and confidence that, I mean, I would put Wisconsin's election integrity laws up against any other state in the country, Maggie. I really would. I think that we run them well. You ran Milwaukee County's legal department. You know this.
Yeah, sure do.
So actually, I'm going to argue with you a second here, Mike, if I can. I'll tell you a state that does it. I'll tell you a state that does it better, Nebraska. Nebraska is the only state in the country that uses election worker subpoenas like jury subpoenas. So you get a summons in Nebraska, you have to cover four elections. Half the poll workers in Nebraska this time out will be people who are only there because they would have been arrested if they didn't show up, and they would have been fined. And in my podcast, Lost Middle, which Civic Media has played a big role in putting together, we actually talked to the guy who runs elections in Nebraska. And he said, look, you know, I was walking down the hallway one of the last elections, and in comes the mayor's husband. And he looks at him and says, Ron, what are you doing here? And he says, well, you should the hell know why I'm doing here, because you're the guy who sent me the letter that I've now got to be a poll worker for the next four elections. And here's the really cool part of it, right? If you have an election system like Nebraska does, people experience the polls close up. I mean, they're there. Yeah. They see how they operate. Mm-hmm. And the same way that if you've ever been on jury duty, you appreciate how well the system works. Mm-hmm. And the second part of it is, if you want to have an election conspiracy to defraud the election, good luck doing it with half the people in the room who are only there so they don't get arrested. So I think Wisconsin and a lot of other states around the country should really take a look at Nebraska, because I think it's a groundbreaking idea, and it gives people exposure to how the process works, and you get people inside who are going to watch it like a hawk, because they know they'll be in trouble if something gets screwed up while they're there.
I love that idea. I actually was unaware of that, and I think that's a fabulous reform that we should absolutely pursue here. But I think it speaks to the point of, you know, inside a polling place, inside Central Count, there are thousands of people. If you were going to try to commit some sort of fraud, the conspiracy would need to involve thousands of people. It's just not possible to commit voter fraud.
Well, but I'll just say this about any conspiracy, right, is that people start talking about it, right? Well, I was asked to do this. There aren't any of those people, because they don't exist. I wanted to ask you a question, Scott. As an attorney...
I'm not one.
Are you? You're not. I know that you work at Foley. I saw you on the web. So you're not a JD.
I am not. I just hang out with...
No pun intended.
1,500 lawyers. Well, I have an MBA
Brave man indeed, on both counts. Then let me reframe the question, but I'll ask it in a different vein. As a Republican, how do you view the attacks on the institutions, right? That our voting system is one of our institutions, but where do you think the integrity of our democracy lies when you hear Donald Trump say things like, I want to be a dictator for a day, or whatever his exact words were? What's your gut reaction when you hear those things? Do you just chalk it up to rhetoric?
Well, look, I don't like the rhetoric of either party. I'm a confirmed political orphan at this point in my career. I'm from the libertarian wing of the Republican Party. I don't like the government very involved in my life and my business and my faith and my bedroom and anything else in the world. So the sooner they can downsize the federal government, the happier I'll be. But I, you know, I think the rhetoric's been just as bad on the Democratic side about attacking Trump and, you know, saying we got to get rid of him, we got to stop him, whatever it is. So from my perspective, a pox on both their houses. I think that's really the place where most voters are going to be. And just not to add to the conspiracy theory, I just want to let you know my battery's pretty low, so I don't want your listeners to think you suddenly sensing me because you don't agree.
That's especially important for our listeners. I'll just say this, Scott, with a lot of respect for your service, I couldn't disagree with you more. It was not Democrats storming the Capitol on January 6th. We're going to have to leave it there, gentlemen. It was really a distinct pleasure to have you both. Yeah. Thank you for your service to our democracy in the Democracy Defense Project. Again, ladies and gentlemen listening out there, you can find out more about the great work being done by former Republican congressional representative of the 2nd District of Wisconsin, Scott Klug, as well as former Democratic Party chair for the state of Wisconsin, Mike Tate, at democracydefenseproject.org. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network's live coverage of the 2024 RNC from downtown Milwaukee. Your farm update and other news is next. Don't go anywhere. I'll be right back.
Thank you.
Wisconsin. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network special live coverage of the Republican National Convention 2024 from downtown Milwaukee. The breeze is blowing, the helicopters are flying, and I'm really excited to welcome my next guest, Amy Hanauer, Executive Director for the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Thanks so much for making time, Amy. I love it. I've got a nerd. I mean that with love and respect, a fellow nerd on the line with me. It always makes me excited on a nice Wednesday afternoon. Tell us, Amy, your organization has been taking a look at the Trump tax cuts from 2018, which right. resulted for the first time in billionaires, that is billionaires with a B, being taxed at a lower effective tax rate than everyone else in America. What else has your research shown?
Yeah, great to be here. I'm with Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, and we are your very favorite tax wonks. And yeah, I mean, the main thing that we saw from the Trump tax changes is huge cuts to corporations, huge cuts to the very wealthiest, huge increases in inequality, huge increases in the deficit and the debt. You know, and nothing trickling down, which that's not news to any of us. But, you know, these big, enormous, incredibly profitable corporations saw their tax rates fall from 22% effective rate down to 12.8%. You know, there were some claim that we're going to lower the rate and then everybody's going to actually pay the rate that they're supposed to pay. That totally didn't happen. These corporations paid $240 billion less in taxes over the first couple of years, and if they'd continue to pay the effective rates. And what that means is like less for relieving student loan debt, less for lowering the cost of college, less for parents to get childcare, less for us to take care of our elderly relatives, less for us to get health care. So, you know, that's what those tax cuts did.
I was interested to see some of the specifics of your research, Amy. especially you isolated and looked at just under 300 of America's largest and most consistently profitable corporations. Tell us what you found as their taxes were going up. What was happening to those corporate profits? And again, profits being specifically after expenses.
Yeah. No, and their taxes were going down, to be clear. So, yeah, their yes. profits rose by 44%, but their federal tax bills dropped by 16%. And, you know, the number of the corporations that were paying less than 10% in taxes almost doubled. And you're talking about many of the largest and most well-known corporations in the country, Walmart, Verizon, Disney, Meta, which is Facebook. Huge tax reductions after the Trump tax law went into effect. You know, Verizon alone would have paid $11 billion more in taxes if its rate hadn't dropped. And their profits were going up, but what they were paying was going down. So that just means, like, you know, they're using our infrastructure to install their, you know, to install their private infrastructure, and they're not paying for it. They're hiring workers who come out of our colleges and our public schools, and they're not helping make make those schools better, and they're not helping make that college affordable. So then that's pushed down to, you know, working people to pay the taxes that account for that.
That's such a critical couple of points that you just made there, Amy. I'd like to lean in a little bit on those. The first one was that when we look at large corporations in the United States, they're, quote, using our infrastructure. What you mean by that, and I'll ask you to correct me if I get any of this wrong, what you mean by that is they're moving their goods around on our roads that taxpayers, middle class people, pay for. They're erecting their cell phone towers, often on public land. Again, they're getting their workers from our school system. So what you're really talking about is this social contract between corporations and the communities in which they sell their products, and also the communities in which they reside. And it seems to me that what you're describing is a breaking of that social contract. And absolute dollars, I know you mentioned Verizon would have paid $11 billion more in taxes between 2018 and 21 without the Trump corporate and wealthy tax cuts. What are we talking about in total money lost because Donald Trump wanted to give out favors to his wealthy friends and the richest corporations?
Yeah, so it's like Verizon would have paid $11 billion more. Walmart would have paid $9 billion more. AT&T would have paid $8 billion more. Meta would have paid $8 billion more. And, you know, just we looked at the 300 largest, essentially. And if you just look at those 300 largest, they paid collectively $240 billion less in taxes from 2018 to 2021. And so, yeah, like you said, it's less for roads, it's less for schools, it's less for college affordability, it's less for elderly care. And that's why, like, the citizens of a lot of other countries can count on a set of basics that we can't count on, that we're left scrambling in America. We're left scrambling if we've got elderly parents. We're left scrambling if we've got young kids. And frankly, you know, we're often left scrambling with roads and trains and bridges that are just not up to snuff. So, and it's all because of this underpayment. And as you said, you know, these companies benefit more from the things that the public sector provides, but they're paying in less.
What's the end game here, Amy? You know, when you sort of like, and so forth, if this continues to go on like this, what can middle-class Americans expect? I mean, at the end of the day, isn't the ultimate result that higher tax burdens, more of middle-class worker paychecks will be have to be paid in taxes, or serious cuts to things like Medicare and Social Security will need to be made? Is that the end game here, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, we all remember a sort of right-wing operative who said, let's make government small enough to drown it in a bathtub. And I think that is the end game. You know, there's just not, there's a desire to let wealthy people have access to private institutions that regular people can't get access to, whether it's private schools or private country clubs or private colleges.
Or privatized healthcare. Yes.
Privatized healthcare. Yeah, we've all seen that, like, you know, we've all seen that you have to get these add-ons, even if you're eligible for Medicare. You know, we've all seen these examples. And then they don't care about the quality of what's distributed to the rest of us. And I'll say something else, and I would love to get back to this point about the kind of, you know, just devolution of government or devaluing of government. But the other thing is that these corporate tax cuts actually incredibly increase inequality. Because if you think about who are the corporate stockholders, first of all, 40% of American corporate stock is owned by foreign investors. So the minute you cut corporate taxes, 40%, 40 cents of every dollar you cut goes straight out of the country to foreign investors. So that's not helping Americans of any income level or of any race. And then aside from that, you know, another 50% just goes to the 20% of the richest people. So the bottom 80% of Americans of all races are kind of sharing 10% of any corporate tax cuts. And then, as you say, it means that we have less to pay down the debt and the deficit and less to spend on all of the things that make our country function.
Yeah, it's really stunning. When we look at the shocking increase in wealth inequality since the 50s, the trajectory is truly stunning. And what we also know unequivocally and very clearly is that tax rates really reached their peak in this country in World War II and have just declined precipitously and steadily since then. So the very foundational argument that is made that by giving tax cuts to billionaires and millionaires and 300 of our country's most successful corporations, that's somehow going to benefit the middle class. The data simply proves otherwise. Tax rates are down from their peak in World War II times, and wealth inequality has skyrocketed in this country.
Right.
Them's the facts. I just don't know how people can be convinced otherwise. What's the fundamental message that you would share with people who may be listening, Amy?
Yeah, I mean, the fundamental message that I would share is that, you know, the people down the street from you at the Republican convention are looking to continue to slash taxes for wealthy people, to slash taxes for billionaires, to slash taxes for corporations, and to enable dynastic wealth to be passed, like uber wealth to be passed from generation to generation to generation without anyone ever seeing any of that revenue devoted back to the public good. And they did it the last time that they held control, and they'll do it even worse this time around. And I think we see a stark contrast in what was done under the Inflation Reduction Act, for example, where we increased funding to crack down on corporate tax avoiders, to crack down on billionaire tax avoiders. And we're seeing the revenue come in from that really, really strong. In the Inflation Reduction Act, where we passed a corporate minimum tax so that the biggest, wealthiest corporations would have to pay at least something, even if they use tax breaks to get out of some other aspects of tax. And, you know, that was all what was passed with a 50-50 Senate with some really, challenging sort of political circumstances. I think if you look at the vision of progressive Democrats, you see a real vision for going far beyond that and saying, no, you know, we got to get wealthy people and corporations to pay their fair share. And we can use that to reinvest in things that help all of us. We can build economic equity, we can build racial equity, and we can build a better country.
Yeah, I've often been left sort of mouth agape because I hear all sorts of people from the right making the argument that the Inflation Reduction Act and the other economic measures that President Biden deployed to try to bring our economy back from the brink, oh, well, that's why inflation is so high. The reality of the matter is government spending or supports for infrastructure, middle-class jobs, child care, is exactly economically equivalent to a tax cut. In other words, right, by not taking in that revenue from the richest corporations and the wealthiest Americans, that's just as economically it impacts the bottom line just like any direct government spending exiting. If that was all so great, then why exactly is no one calling out the Trump tax cuts as a possible source of inflationary pressures? I've digressed. Amy, can you stick around for another segment?
I would love to.
Wonderful. I've got Amy Hanauer, the Executive Director for the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, my special guest this half hour. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is the Civic Media Radio Network's special live coverage of the 2024 Democratic National Convention, coming to you live from downtown Milwaukee. We're going to talk a little bit about what Trump has planned for his second term when it comes to cutting taxes even more for the wealthiest Americans and our most profitable corporations when we come back after these brief messages. Stay put, everybody. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Maggie Dawn. You're listening to the Civic Media Radio Network, giving you special live coverage of the 2024 RNC from downtown Milwaukee. My special guest this half hour, Amy Hanauer, Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. Again, thanks, Amy. Really happy to have you here. We've been talking about how the Trump tax cuts from 2018 resulted in approximately $240 billion less in taxes collected from 2018 to 2021, just for the 300 largest and consistently profitable corporations in the U.S. But Amy, Donald Trump wants to take taxes even lower for corporations, doesn't he?
I've seen, and you know, of course, it can be hard to pin down what his real policy proposals are, but there's this project called Project 2025 that the Heritage Foundation put out. That's a right-wing think tank that kind of steers the policy approach of the Republican Party. And what they've put forth is just a bonanza of colossal tax cuts for the very wealthiest people and for corporations, cutting taxes for mega investors, and a huge shift from taxing the wealthy to taxing the middle class. And I think that's a really important part of all of this, is that it's not just that they cut taxes. They cut taxes in ways that end up raising taxes for regular people, or, as you said, cutting things that families need in such a way that it's equivalent to a tax cut. Because if you have, you know, if you have low-cost college versus high-cost college, you're paying a tax. If healthcare is free versus if healthcare costs a lot, it's essentially a tax. But even on the taxes itself, Project 2025 would shift, like a family of four earning about $100,000 would end up with a $2,600 tax hike, while a family earning $5 million would get a $325,000 tax cut. And that's kind of the Project 2025 approach, which, as best as we can tell, would be what Trump would likely embrace.
Can you say that again, Amy? Because I need to take a note. Under Project 2025, which is, I won't ask you to say it this way, Amy, because I will. Project 2025 is Trump's marching orders from the far right and America's billionaire set. Say again, a family of four earning $100,000 under Project 2025 proposed tax plan, their taxes are going up. But what was the second? Tell me that again.
So, yeah.
Those numbers are staggering.
Yeah. So basically, you know, you're a family of four, you're earning $100,000. Our friends at the Center for American Progress have estimated that you'd get a $2,600 tax hike. $2,600 tax hike. But a family earning $5 million or an individual earning $5 million would end up with a $325,000 tax cut. So the public sector would have a lot less money. The wealth of billionaires would have a lot more money, and regular people would have less in their pocketbooks and would also be facing higher costs for healthcare, higher costs for education, or less adequate public services.
Wow. It's just staggering.
And just, you know, and Maggie, just to give you like a sense, sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but like just for an example, and I went through mostly just the tax provisions in this, but like in Project 2025, it proposes, just for an example, eliminating Head Start. Okay, Head Start is something that supports early childhood care for low-income families. It's been an incredibly successful part of our public infrastructure. It's especially hard-hitting for rural communities. 40% of rural child care centers in states like Kentucky and Minnesota, and I'm sure Wisconsin too, are Head Start funded. And, you know, they just want to get rid of it. Or, for example, the Inflation Reduction Act, that was like the biggest investment in greening our infrastructure. It's created so many jobs in the green infrastructure. It's created manufacturing jobs. It's created construction jobs. It's actually disproportionately created those jobs in low-income areas of the country. And, you know, the Project 2025 would totally get rid of those green tax credits. So they would stop trying to have tax policy be a tool for greening our economy. Instead, they would turn tax policy into a tool for supercharging inequality.
That's Amy Hanauer, the executive director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, my special guest this half hour. We talked about, Amy, an individual or family under Project 2025 proposed tax plan earning $5 million would see a $325,000 cut in their taxes, while a family of four earning $100,000 would see a tax increase of $2,600. That's under the Project 2025 proposals. It's still really bad if we're just talking about the Donald J. Trump 2018 tax cuts and giveaways to corporations and billionaires. What are some of the statistics on what that tax cut will result in 2025 and 2026, even if Project 2025 doesn't get their way?
Yeah, well, just like, as I said, I mean, the corporate tax cuts, 40% of them flow immediately out of the country. And then the 50%, so not 50% goes straight to the top 20% of families. So you're looking at 90% that either goes to the very richest Americans or goes out of the country. And even within that 20%, the vast majority goes to the top 5%. And, you know, if you want to look at race and ethnicity, you know, Black Americans constitute 12% of the population. They get just 1% of the tax cuts. Hispanic Americans, Hispanic households constitute 9% of households. They get just 1% of the tax cuts. So you're really multiple race households, 8% of the population. They get just 1% of the tax cuts. And even white families, right? Because so much goes right out of the country, white families constitute 67% of the population, but they get only 53% of the tax cuts. And it's mostly the very wealthiest white families that get anything at all. So it's an outrage, Maggie.
Thank you so much, Amy. I appreciate you taking the time this afternoon to break it all down for us. If you're for billionaires and the richest corporations getting more tax breaks, then vote for Donald Trump. It's that simple.
That's right.
My guest was Amy Hanauer, Executive Director of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. I'll be sure to have you back if you've got the time, Amy. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, we love talking to you. Thanks so much.
Wonderful. I'm Maggie Dawn. This is Civic Media Radio Network special live coverage of the 2024 Republican National Convention. I'm super stoked because I'm going to be joined by your friends and mine, Mike Crute and Dominic Salvia of the Devil's Advocates, up next.
Sign on with the devil.
I'm Satan reincarnated.